Hello and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host tonight, Kay Poppy, and it's Halloween night, so what better time to talk about the endlessly interesting yet always mysterious creatures, the bats. And here in the studio with me today is conservation biologist and bat expert, Jennifer Riddell. Thanks for being here, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
So you hear all of the lore in the around Halloween with bats, but they actually do quite a bit of good for humans. So I was wondering if you could start out by talking about some of the good things that bats do.
Oh, right. So bats are these amazing animals. They're really important, and they have a variety of roles that they play in nature, and we're part of nature. So yes, they do benefit us in a variety of ways. So if, you know, I think it's important to start by mentioning that bats are an entire order of mammals, right? So there's more than 1,400 different species around the world. And when we look at bats all over the world, we've got groups of bats that are pollinating bats, that are nectar feeders, and fruit-eating bats that are then seed dispersers, and then insect-eating bats, and some others out there as well. But the bats that are local to us in Wisconsin and the Midwest are insectivorous. So we tend to, you know, let people know about the insect eating benefits to humans. And that's not just for the, you know, sort of typical, everyone says bats eat mosquitoes, right? Everybody seems to know that now, but it's way more than just mosquitoes. It's beetles and moths and midges and flies, true bugs, and 24 different types of agricultural pests, forestry pests like the spongy moth. And when it does come to public health and the benefit that bats provide by eating mosquitoes, we know, thanks to some research by Amy Ray at UW-Madison, that bats in Wisconsin are eating 17 different types of mosquitoes, and 9 of those carry West Nile virus. So some clear benefits, you know, in terms of their diets. So if you think of bats, you know, helping with pest control, USGS calculated the value of bats to our Wisconsin farmers based on acres of harvestable cropland. And it turns out that our bats are saving Wisconsin farmers somewhere between $658 million to $1.5 billion annually in pesticide costs, and that includes application costs. But they're eating corn borer, cutworm moth, grasshoppers, cucumber beetle, and a variety of other ag pests. There's some really interesting work out of Southern Illinois University as well, where one of the students actually took these big nets and netted off huge sections of cornfields. And so he was looking at the effect of bats on controlling corn earworm. And if you remove bats from the cornfield, it turns out there's a 60% increase in larval density on corn plants and a 50% increase in kernel damage from corn earworm. So yeah, some really measurable stuff. And, you know, unfortunately, we kind of had to go make these measurements and sort of prove the value of bats because white-nose syndrome was becoming an issue in North America. We needed to fund that, and bats historically have been misunderstood and therefore underfunded and understudied. And all of that contributes to why one of the reasons white-nose syndrome has been kind of difficult to be prepared for and to respond to quickly.
So you hear about white-nose syndrome a lot. I was wondering if you could go into a little more depth about what it is specifically, where it came from, and when it started showing up in the U.S.
Yeah. So it's a disease of hibernating bats, and like any disease, there's a pathogen that can be transmitted that's causing it to spread and affect the bats. So it's a fungal pathogen. The fungus is native to Europe and Asia. We know it's very widespread there. And it arrived here in North America probably in 2006 or 2007. We saw the disease first show up at just one site in New York State, and then very quickly, within a couple of years, it had spread out to neighboring sites. So the bats are moving the fungus from the humid, dark cave environment where fungi thrive, and as they move around the landscape, interact with other bats in other cave hibernacula, they're taking that fungus into those other sites, contaminating the environment, healthy bats come in, pick up the fungus. And then when the bat goes to hibernate, it's cooling down its body in order to conserve energy. And this is a cold-loving fungus, and so it can't grow here, you know, at room temperature. Bats don't get white-nose syndrome, you know, in the summer months or in their bat house. They only get it when their body cools down, the fungus grows on them, and it damages their skin. It grows into the living skin tissue and creates lesions and tears. It also causes the bat to wake up. So every few days, that bat is warming its body up and burning through perhaps 30 to 60 days worth of stored fat reserves that would otherwise see it through this long winter when there's no insects available. And then very quickly, it's moving up onto the landscape, you know, looking for insects, but it's the dead of winter. So it's dying of exposure, being predated on, you know, or dying within the site. And what happens is as this disease marched, you know, from the East Coast across the country, we see sort of a three-year decline where the disease arrives. You lose about 50% of the bats in the first year and closer to 80 and 90% in the second and third year. And so that disease arrived here in Wisconsin in 2014. And by 2019, we had really kind of hit rock bottom with numbers of bats in hibernation sites with very few bats remaining underground. Now the disease has marched its way to the West Coast.
So do you see it getting a bit better now? Are the numbers increasing as far as population growth?
Or? Yeah, the average decline for little brown bats, and again, like we've got all these different species. We have four different species of hibernating bats in Wisconsin, and the disease affects them all differently. But when we talk about our most common bat, the little brown bat, that's one of the most severely impacted. The average declines are 95% when the disease reaches a hibernation site. Throughout most of our nearly 200 hibernation sites in Wisconsin, we saw those declines. So we saw almost all of the bats disappear. We have many, many sites that are now down to zero and have remained that way. But we've got most of our eggs in three baskets, most of our bats in three mines. You know, more than 95% of our little brown bats are in just three mines in our state. So those are incredibly important sites. And at two of those sites, we only lost, this sounds bad, we only lost about 80% of the little brown bats. That's still a severe decline, but we were left with, you know, thousands of bats still. And it's been really great news because in the last three hibernation surveys, we've seen those numbers creep up to over 50% of what we started with. So bats have grown back in number at those sites, and we're still learning kind of about why that's happening, but it's very hopeful for us, and we're certainly seeing glimmers of population recovery.
And some UW researchers have done research on a new vaccine development. So what does that look like now? Does that seem to be helping?
Yeah, well, when we think of white-nose syndrome, you know, there's been this international response because white-nose caused the most precipitous decline in North American wildlife in recorded history. So there's been a very heavily coordinated research and treatment, you know, and management response. And there have been a variety of treatments and controls that have been looked at, and the vaccine is just one of them. And it happens that the vaccine has been developed here at UW-Madison and the USGS National Wildlife Health Center. It's not like silver bullet. There's no cure for this, and there's no perfect solution because even though we may have a vaccine that protects bats, it's very labor-intensive and sort of invasive to have to capture bats to deliver that vaccine. And we're also, you know, looking at ways to deliver the vaccine in perhaps a spray, right, that could be sprayed somewhere on bats and they would groom the vaccine off of themselves. But even that, you know, may be somewhat invasive and could disturb bat behavior. So all of those things have to be looked at very carefully and tested very carefully. And what we're seeing with white-nose syndrome in the eastern part of the United States and here in the Midwest is that the bats that have survived, that we still have around, so those populations that are increasing, are naturally somehow resisting fungal growth during the winter months. So one of the things we're focused on in Wisconsin is trying to understand what that mechanism might be. We don't know fully yet, but it's probably a variety of factors. And then what can we do to support and encourage whatever's happening that's allowing bats to to survive, you know, really without a lot of human intervention.
And there's only four of the Wisconsin bats are affected by this because the other four migrate.
Right.
Correct?
We have eight species in Wisconsin, and four are migratory. We call those the tree bats. And it's a little bit of a misnomer because all of our bats are using trees in the summertime for roosting. And that includes the hibernating species. But we've got the tree bats and the cave bats. And the tree bats are often solitary in the summer months. They're often roosting in foliage or on bark. And so that's the hoary bat, eastern red bat, silver-haired bat, and evening bat. And they will migrate in the cooler months when there's no insects available. Here, they'll simply go elsewhere, and they do use some periods of torpor or short hibernation, right, where they lower their body temperature and might go into leaf litter on the ground or be roosting in trees. But we don't see them in the winter in Wisconsin. The other side of that coin are the cave bats, and we have four species of cave bats, and these include the two most common. So if you've, you know, out there listening, ever encountered a bat or seen one, there's a really good chance it was either a big brown bat, particularly if it showed up in your house. and it also could have been easily a little brown bat, because those are the two species that use bat houses. They roost in people's attics. Sometimes they get in our homes. And then there's two other cave hibernators, and that's the tricolored bat and the northern long-eared bat. And it's very unlikely that any members of the public have seen those two species in particular. They're quite secretive, as all bats are, but they tend to stay away from homes and buildings more so than little brown and big brown. But we find all of those four in caves and mines in the winter months. They're staying, you know, perhaps in the state year-round. But they certainly do emerge from the cave in the spring, and then they, you know, arrive at our neighborhoods, our bat houses and trees and parks and agricultural areas and forests, and they're all over the landscape in the summer months.
So there's a small chance you might see them this summer.
Yeah, you know, the best time to view a bat is at 30 minutes past sunset. There's sort of a shift change that happens, and the day-flying birds go in, and within about 5 or 10 minutes, you kind of see bats coming out, and there's still a little bit of daylight in that twilight period, and the best place to look for bats is over a water source. So a lake, a pond, a river, bats will emerge from their daytime roost, go down to that water source, and they drink on the wing. And then, of course, there's a lot of insects there, so it's a great place for them to hang out for a couple of hours and forage.
So this might be a good time to shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the citizen science projects going on at the Wisconsin Bat Program. What can people do to get involved?
Right. We really rely on citizen volunteers because they are sort of the eyes and ears on bats in Wisconsin. So the best thing that folks can do is if they have bats roosting in their bat house or in a barn or a building, if they haven't yet joined the roost monitoring volunteers, that would be a great thing for people to do. And we have a form on our website, so it's easy to conduct a roost emergence count. Again, on that summer evening, 30 minutes past sunset, you sort of stand outside the building or the bat house, and the bats will drop out and sort of fly off, and they're fairly easy to count. You can even get a little clicker app for your phone. Some people tally on a piece of paper. But we want people to report those numbers because that really helps us, you know, that's like keeping a finger on the pulse of what's going on with bats in Wisconsin, particularly because at the summer roosts, those are often maternity colonies, and so it's mother bats giving birth to their pups. And we have two Great Wisconsin Bat Counts, one in early June. And if you participate in that Great Wisconsin Bat Count weekend, you're going to count just the mother bats coming out. And if you participate again at the end of July or mid-July, then you'll see also the pups are now flying. The young of the year are joining the mothers, so your number in your bat roost should double. And we also have a number of volunteers who still participate in acoustic monitoring, where we can take a bat detector out on the landscape at night in the summer when bats are hunting and foraging using echolocation. And each bat species has a different sounding call. Like if we actually listen in with the help of a bat detector, you know, we can hear the difference with our ears, but back at the office, we're using a software program to analyze those calls and identify species with some manual vetting as well. But it gives us, when folks conduct acoustic surveys, either by walking or paddling on water or driving with that bat detector on a summer night, the detector's recording the calls, and then we get essentially an idea of who's out there, right? We're looking at our species diversity and relative abundance, and then we can measure year to year how that's changing on our summer landscape. So for example, prior to white-nose syndrome, when we look at our acoustic surveys, statewide, our most common bat was, you know, typically little brown bat, and now we've seen that shift. And when we look at those summer surveys, we're seeing hoary bats and big brown bats are the most common species encountered on the summer landscape.
Is the echolocation a handheld device that someone would point at outside, or what does that look like?
Right. There's a couple of different types of bat detectors. The kind that we use for citizen-based monitoring, we lend out. But yeah, it's a handheld device. We also have a, you know, extendable microphone that goes up on your car if you're doing a driving route for us. But you know, you're holding on to it and you're getting to listen to bat calls in real time, which is fun for volunteers and enjoy the lovely evening. And oftentimes you'll, you know, see bats as they're swooping down low or over the water. There's a couple of other bat detectors that are available out there for enthusiasts. One is called the Echometer Touch, and it's a little device that can plug into your smart device and will give you a real-time sonogram on your screen, kind of a nice color display, and there's an auto ID program so you can see in real time which bats you're encountering. Those are actually a lot more affordable than bat detectors used to be, so that's a good option for people who want to just see what's in their backyard and neighborhood.
So you can't actually hear the bat calls, but you can see them on the program, right?
Right. Bats are typically always calling above the range of human hearing. And again, different species have, you know, different frequencies. So for example, the hoary bat, which is our largest bat in Wisconsin, is also our lowest frequency bat. And that's because it's a bat that's hunting very large insects kind of in big open areas and clearings in the forest. So it's hunting large-bodied moths and beetles, and it's using low-frequency sound that can kind of travel out far and bounce back to the bat. Not provide a lot of high detail, but that's what it's using. And so hoary bats call right at the upper range of human hearing. And if you've got a bat detector and you're a young person or don't have too much hearing damage, I always like to say if you haven't been to too many rock concerts, maybe you can even hear hoary bats just with your ears. It's a very, very high-pitched, higher than a mosquito whine. But you really need a bat detector with the volume turned off to be able to sort of train yourself to recognize hoary bat calls.
And on bat boxes, is a bat box something that someone can just put up anywhere in their backyard? Should they be looking for certain locations? You mentioned water. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else to keep in mind?
Yeah, you'll have the best chance of success with bat houses if they're within a quarter mile of water. And for many of us in Wisconsin and certainly in the Madison area, that's pretty easy to come by. But we want to put a bat house at least 8 feet off the ground, ideally higher up if you can get it higher. The bats need space to drop out. We want it in full sun, depending on what that means for you and your property. And we don't want it on a tree because predators hang out on trees, so bats tend to avoid bat houses that are either on a tree or on the tree line. Similarly, the tree provides shade, right? We want our bat house out in full sun. So there's no secret for, you know, magic tricks or anything for getting bats to move in. I've had bat houses on my home as a bat biologist for, gosh, 15 years now. And I live here in Madison near the lakes, and I have managed to have a couple of big brown bats. They're probably males. Occasionally roost there later in summer. So, you know, even as a bat biologist, I can't get bats to just move into my bat houses. The reason I have three bat houses is that I've got them facing different directions on different corners of my home. And so if we give bats a variety of conditions to choose from, that's the best way to encourage them in addition to living near water.
So you mentioned you had male bats, and then before you mentioned the mother bats. So do they go to different bat houses during the summer, or how does that work?
Yeah, the females, if they're little browns or big browns, and some of the other species as well, but the females will gather together to form a nursery colony or a maternity roost where they're, you know, giving birth to their pup, and before the pup can fly, that pup is very vulnerable. It stays up in the bat house or the attic or the barn or under the bark of a tree. And mom goes out and hunts at night you know, she comes back and nurses her pup, and she's a great mother bat. The pups can't fly until around July 15th. They're born around June 1st. The males are often solitary out on the landscape. Sometimes we'll see small bachelor colonies of just a few males together, and that might be in a bat house, might be, you know, in a building or a tree. But when we get large numbers of bats, those are typically always maternity colonies. And yes, they want the warmth of the bat house so that that pup can stay warm and develop well, even when mom is out hunting.
So what is the best environment or condition for bats, other than caves, of course, and what makes caves appealing to bats?
Right. So a lot of ways to kind of dig into that topic. In Wisconsin especially, we have great forest resources and water resources, and all of those are wonderful for bats. So again, depending on species, we've got bats using a variety of habitats to hunt for different types of prey. So when they're out foraging at night, they want to forage typically along edges of tree lines because of predator protection, but also there's reduced wind speed near the tree line, so there's higher insect activity there. And then they might also be using those tree lines to like navigate across the landscape. They're using small clearings in forested areas. And of course, we want to provide them with clean drinking water. We do a pretty good job with that in Wisconsin, keeping our drinking water clean for us and our wild animals. When it comes to roosts, as I said, you know, dead standing trees, you know, if you're a forest owner, if you can leave those snags standing, if it's safe to do so, that's the best option we can give bats and other wildlife. But in absence of buildings where bats are roosting or dead trees with loose bark and cracks and crevices, we can provide bat houses. And if you go on the DNR website and search bats, you can find instructions for the bat houses, including guidance about where to place them, or if you're going to purchase them, what to look for, because not all bat houses are created equal. We want you to give them the right thing that they will actually use if you're investing in them. And then in the winter months, again, those cave hibernators all want slightly different conditions. So when it comes to little brown bats, they want it fairly cold underground, ideally 45 degrees Fahrenheit or a little bit lower than that. They also need high humidity, which is why we don't see little browns in homes and buildings. Big brown bats can tolerate drier conditions better, so they will sometimes overwinter in a basement or an attic. But when it comes to little browns, they need that high humidity underground. They also need avoidance of disturbance. So we don't want to see sites where, you know, raccoons can easily reach them. So they're typically, you know, hanging up high on the ceiling. And similarly, we don't want people entering hibernation sites disturbing bats when they're attempting to hibernate. So all of those factors come into play when it comes to bats, you know, selecting either on the landscape in the summer or below ground where they're going to hibernate.
And Wisconsin has a few different caves. Which ones have the highest bat populations?
Yeah, we have close to 200 underground, let's say, subterranean sites. And it's everything from natural limestone caves to, you know, anthropogenic, human-made mines and root cellars and beer caves and tunnels and similar underground structures. So again, they're all providing those cool, damp conditions where the bat can hibernate. But about 60% of those sites are natural caves. The rest are typically mines. And because of our lead and zinc mining history, most of those are in southwest Wisconsin, a few iron mines as well. But interestingly, there's just three sites, again, that bats primarily are selecting to hibernate in. One is Nita Mine in Dodge County, a former iron mine, and then the other two sites are Bay City and Maiden Rock mines in Pierce County. And those are former silica sand mines, eventually used for fracking. And so these are all abandoned sites that are incredibly important for thousands and thousands of bats. And we know that bats are not just coming from across Wisconsin. They're coming in from other states to use these sites in the winter months. And they're critically important. So we are really focused on those sites, both monitoring what's happening there, but also protecting them and the bats that are using them.
And all four of Wisconsin's hibernating species will use those.
That's right. You know, when you walk into a hibernation site, up near the entrance or near the entrances or the passageways that are connecting entrances, it's very cold, often near freezing conditions, or it does go below freezing. And that's where we see big brown bats. If we go further into the site, things get a little more stable. The temperature stabilizes, there's higher humidity, and then we start to encounter little brown bats. And if we, you know, go into the warmest corners of the site where there's not a lot of airflow, and we look up at the ceiling pockets, you know, where warm air gets trapped and there's not a lot of breeze or air movement, that's where we find tricolored bats, because they really like it to be quite warm. And then similarly, when we see a tricolored or a northern long-eared, it's almost always by itself, right? Hanging alone, solitary.
Oh, interesting.
When we see little browns, they're in these clusters or groups. And similarly with big browns, we can see large clusters of big browns, hundreds of bats in some cases clustered together.
So are they always solitary, or is that just when they're hibernating?
Well, it's, you know, one of the things that's interesting about bats, and again, the differences between species. So we do have some bats that are quite solitary. The tricolored bats are gathered together in small maternity colonies in the summer when they're up on the landscape. So again, the females gathering for that shared warmth to rear pups. But underground, and probably the rest of the year, they seem to be solitary. But little browns and big browns, again, different story. Like, they're gathering together at these really critical phases in their life cycle, either in hibernation or in summer roost sites. And it's one of the things that makes bats in general as a group of animals vulnerable to decline, because they are reliant on just a few critical, you know, places, and then they're gathering in huge numbers. So I can take, you know, spatially a very small area of the footprint of a mine or a cave, and hundreds of thousands of bats could be gathered in this one tiny spot. But in the summertime, they spread out to thousands of square miles of people's farms, forests, and neighborhoods, and continue to come back just to that one special spot each winter. So when animals are gathering, it makes it easy for disease to spread. If a natural disaster or flooding, collapse, something like that happens very quickly, a large number of bats, of course, can be taken off the entire landscape.
So there's a lot of lore around bats. Is there anything that's particularly misunderstood that you'd like to tell people about?
Yeah, there's a lot of misunderstanding. Obviously, there's a lot of mythology and sort of tales that are told, and I don't even like to restate them, because when I work with students and young people, many of them haven't even heard the myths about bats, so I don't want to be the one to introduce them. So that's, you know, just like one tip that I'll give give to folks, is don't share the misinformation inadvertently. The misunderstanding, I think, that I want people to come away with is that if you do see a bat on the ground or outside during the daytime, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something wrong with it. We get a lot of calls, particularly at the end of July, when people are noticing bats on the ground or bats down low on a tree or on a building. Those are often young of the year. They're the juveniles that are just learning to fly. So assume that the bat is fine. If it's in an area where it could be approached by, you know, a dog or a child, you may need to move it, you know, off of a sidewalk or something. And again, don't touch the animal with your bare hands. You're going to use, you know, ideally the cardboard box method and kind of get it off into a sheltered location. But most of the time, we just want people to let wild be wild, right? We want to let bats go about their business and be on their way. But in the fall and spring especially, again, we get a lot of calls about bats kind of hanging out under overhangs, and there's not a chance that somebody's going to reach up and encounter them directly. We can just leave them be.
All right. Well, this has been so much fun. Do you have any closing thoughts for people?
I would love it if everyone can help bats by being a bat advocate. So if you like them and appreciate them, you know, as you hear family, friends, or neighbors perhaps sometimes share some stories where maybe there's some misunderstanding, you know, just help steer them in the right direction and share what you know that is positive, or that you can help them interpret bat behavior.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
And you have been listening to Jennifer Riddell, conservation biologist and expert on bats. Thanks for listening, and have a great night.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. This is Eric from Fruit Bats, here to tell you how to make sure your voice is heard. Wisconsinites can visit myvote.wi.gov If you vote in person, you must bring ID. Be heard. Go vote.